having that government backing gives project developers confidence now that there's a future for us. Like, the governments are backing us. Like, there's a potential carbon revenue here, not just from the voluntary side and for good acting corporate, but from the compliance side as well. So it's starting to get those wheels turning from the supplier side, so developers can be confident that they can invest their money into getting the projects off the ground.
Carbon Stations, today's carbon industry leaders.
Are you passionate about climate action and staying on top of the latest trends in the world of carbon capture, removal, and markets? Then the Carbon Herald has you covered. Every week, we bring you the top news, breakthroughs, and insights from the world of carbon management, delivered straight to your inbox. No fluff, no jargon, just the essential info you need to stay informed. So whether you're a climate professional or just someone who cares, make sure you're subscribed. Visit carbonherald.com and sign up today for our weekly newsletter. Welcome to the Carbon Stations podcast, where we speak to some of the leading figures in the emerging carbon industry. Today, we're speaking to Fiona Pereira, Manager of Methodology Development and Innovations at Gold Standard. Fiona, I'm really glad to welcome you here today. Now, before we dive deep into all the very important work you do at Gold Standard, I'd like to first take a step back and talk about what you used to do before all this, as it's always a very curious matter given how new this industry still is.
Yeah, sure. And thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Taking a step back from the beginning, I started a university. I did my degree in environmental sciences. I was obsessed with rocks as a kid. This degree had rocks in it. And that was kind of, I think, the extent of my decision making at that time. Then after my degree, I wasn't quite finished studying, so I stayed on and did a PhD in materials chemistry. And it was during this research that was one of my kind of first direct experiences with sustainable development. So I worked to remediate toxic mining waste, some really nasty stuff containing arsenic, containing uranium. And this was contaminating the local environment and posing a real risk to human health. So I found that the application of my science and research to something so important, very rewarding. So after I finished my PhD and this work, I went into consulting full-time to continue this, the application of science and R&D for real-world problems. But in consulting, I found what I didn't like was the projects were quite short-lived. And I felt like my work wasn't contributing to a kind of single greater purpose or mission like it had in my PhD. So that's when I started trying to narrow a focus more on sustainable development, but then also climate change as well. And that's what brought me to carbon markets. And of course, thinking about these two things, that's where Gold Standard really stood out. So it's very well respected in the market. It's been there for over 20 years, and there's the focus not just on carbon, but on wider sustainable development. And you really feel this mission drive working for the organization. So my colleagues, we all share that same vision, and so the work feels very rewarding. We're all on the same page. We're all working towards the same goals. So I've been at Gold Standard for a couple of years now. I manage methodology development. So working with project developers who want to get certified with us, but they can't because that isn't a methodology which covers their project type. So I help these developers to get new methodologies approved, both advising from kind of scientific side, but also helping to lead them through our governance process for approval. So we see a lot of really cool new ideas being submitted and presented to us. The work is very varied, and it's really, really interesting topic.
Excellent. Fiona, in addition to working with Gold Standard, I know that you're also a member of the SBTi Removals Expert Working Group. How do your roles differ from one another in these organizations, or where do they overlap?
Yeah, so with the SBTi, I'm kind of thinking about the other side of things. So with methodologies, we're mainly looking about how claims can be made and how carbon credits could be issued. But then with the SBTi, we're thinking about the full picture kind of end to end, like how should those carbon credits be used in high integrity applications. So it's really important to consider both of these so we can design a carbon market that's fit for purpose and it's robust. So in the removals, we're focusing specifically on what removals credits can be used for. And for me personally as well, I find it a really good place to discuss this. We hear the nature-based versus tech removals arguments, but there needs to be a space for both. You need both. And so that's some of the work that we're doing with SBTI. So trying to work out what type of credit can be what used for what, and how we make sure that all of the types of credits have a kind of seat at the table so that all of these important projects and the important work can continue to get funded.
Understood. So to clarify, on gold standards side, you kind of work more from the point of view of the supply side?
Exactly.
Okay. And so I'm curious, what does your work involve on a day-to-day basis? And what are some of the areas that you're most focused on right now?
So on a day-to-day basis, I work a lot with project developers and then experts in the field. So project developers who want to develop new methodologies. So we work with them to kind of look at the two main areas of the methodology. So how do we set the rules to make sure that strong projects that will do no harm can be certified under the new methodology? And then how do we set the equations to calculate either the emissions reductions or removals? So it's a lot of kind of working to develop safeguards and also robust accounting methods. And that takes a kind of an army to do. So it's the developers who have the experience on the ground. And then we work with a lot of external experts as well who have expertise in the relevant fields. So working in academia or in carbon market expertise themselves. We work with a lot of experts who consult as well with the UN. So gathering this wealth of information to try and make really strong documents. And then, of course, writing the documents is a whole other ball game. Like we spend a lot of time drafting and redrafting and making sure everything's perfect before it's approved for use.
So introducing kind of a third perspective here, people who are outside of carbon markets, perhaps. So methodologies, as we know, are the backbone of these markets, but to folks outside of this field, it feels a bit abstract. So how would you explain the importance of robust methodologies in ensuring carbon projects genuinely deliver real, incredible impact?
That's a really good question. So I think it really does help to look at methodologies as those two kind of key components. So setting the rules for a project to be eligible and then laying out the equations that we'd need to calculate the quantity of emissions reductions or removals that a project involves. So typically, this is in the context of carbon credits, but a methodology, it doesn't have to be limited to this. It could also be used for impact statements. We do a lot of that gold standard as well. So in terms of making sure it's robust, if we get either of those key elements wrong, so either the rule setting or the equations, we can end up crediting a project that's flawed. So it could cause harm, or we could issue more credits than we should, which means the credit essentially become worthless. And this not only impacts the project itself, but it can cast doubt on the whole market. So particularly for other projects in that kind of same category, we saw this for avoided deforestation after the infamous Guardian article, which it damages bad projects, which as it should, but the problem is it can also damage good projects that are tarred with the same brush. And this is a problem because when done right, carbon credits are a very effective mechanism to channel finance into these really important projects. And we don't want to damage that. We don't want to risk that. So when we're setting rules and we're writing equations in methodologies, we need to make sure that we're doing this conservatively and robustly, so that the credits that we issue are accurate. So one carbon credit is always equal to one ton of carbon reduced or removed. But more importantly, we need to make sure that the credits will do no harm as well. Sorry, that the projects will do no harm.
And on that note, I know you guys recently published the engineered removals activity requirements. I was wondering if you could walk us through that framework and tell us more about it, like who's it for and how the market will essentially benefit from this framework.
Yeah, of course. So we have several methodologies in the removals scope. So I think the first one we released in 2022 that was developed with Newstark, and it covers carbon mineralization. And that was recently approved by ICDCM for CCP labeling, which is very exciting. And then since then, we've been expanding the kind of project offerings in the scope of removals. So in the engineered side, we also have geological storage and we're working on biochar. And then in the nature-based side, we've released a new methodology on mangroves, which was really a highly demanded topic. So it's important to make sure the range of methodologies and the project offerings that we can bring to the market continue to expand. And that's where then the activity requirements document comes in. So where a methodology is project specific, like your geological storage, an activity requirements document is one level above this. So it applies to multiple project types. And it's a document where we detail kind of the high level principles so that we get a consistent approach across all projects in the same sector. So Gold Standard has activity requirements for different sectors. We have community service activities. So kind of your cook stove project is an example. It would fall under that. We have renewable energy. We have blue carbon. And now we have engineered removals. So for the engineered removals, the document will include, or it does include, guidance on what's eligible for certification with us. So some of the engineered removals pathways we're not as confident in yet that we can make sure that the methodologies are robust and conservative. So some of the project types are eligible, some are not currently eligible with us. So the document includes details on that. And then a lot of the key aspects about what would need to be included for reversal risk monitoring, what happens if there is a reversal, and other important requirements such as SDG contributions and impact assessments. So these latter two are particularly important for large scale and industrial CDR projects. And so we put a very strong emphasis on that. And we're also developing guidance on how removals investments and credits should be used. So similar to the work that we've just mentioned about SBTI. So thinking about that end to end. So how should a project look? What does a good project look like? And then all the way through into how should those credits from that project be used?
I'm not sure how much this applies to engineered removals exactly, but I know that Gold Standard is pretty big on co-benefits. Is that kind of an aspect of this framework? Does that apply here at all?
Absolutely. So for every project that we certify, there has to be the climate action, which we'd say is SDG 13. And then there also has to be a contribution to at least two other SDGs. And what we find is that a lot of the really successful projects are contributing to a whole suite of different sustainable development goals. And these are often then what's referred to as the co-benefits. So we know that carbon and climate change, they're not the only problems, unfortunately, that we face. And they're not the only areas in which we can deliver a positive benefit. So we can do much better than that. So taking, for example, a Newstark project, if it's in an industrial area, which is having a lot of operations phased down, we see that in the UK a lot. We're moving away from energy intensive steel production, for example. And then when that factory closes, there's a loss of jobs in the communities, and that can have a whole ripple effect. So we can take industrial and engineered projects and think about where we're putting them and position them in a way to help to facilitate the just transition. And then that has a whole suite of SDG impacts that it can contribute towards, particularly if we're really thoughtful and careful about how these projects are hiring, making sure that gender equality is like paramount during the hiring process, And we can think about projects in this wider scope by how else they can contribute to the communities. So there's this whole domino effect of positive benefit that we can kind of unlock and prioritize. We don't have to limit ourselves to carbon or get what I've heard phrased as carbon tunnel vision, which I think really is a good way to put it. So a lot of our projects, they also create jobs, community resilience, improve water quality, gender equality. Like I said, there's a lot of potential to protect and enhance ecosystems, and then supporting the just transition, particularly for these engineered projects. So at gold standard, we require this broader benefit. And not only do we require it, but we also need to make sure that it's quantified and verified so we can make sure that the benefits are actually happening. And that's as equally as important as the carbon impact itself. And it doesn't have to just sit alongside the carbon benefit as a kind of tick box, but these co-benefits, these SDG impacts, they also feed into and enhance the projects themselves. So for example, in the removal space, if we look at project durability, if a removal project engages with and benefits the community, the project will almost definitely have a longer lifetime. So it's much more powerful when you get the carbon benefit, but the communities and the ecosystems, they are also benefiting. And that's where we see, like I said, the most impactful work and the strongest projects.
I'm curious on that note, whether communication is somehow included in the frameworks, because I remember that a couple of years ago, this was kind of a big discussion of how we communicate carbon removal to the general public and how companies, project developers work together with communities in order to, you know, to see these projects through. I was curious if communication is something you guys also deal with.
Yes, yeah. And that's also baked into both our standard and this removals activities requirements document. So it's really important that the community is engaged from the project design stage. And so that's, we have a whole kind of guide for project developers, or actually a requirement that the community needs to be engaged throughout the design and then the project implementation. So that's called our stakeholder engagement requirements document. And it can be a lot of work for project developers to make sure the community is engaged from the onset, and holding in-person consultations, following up with those consultations, showing how those consultations and the community's feedback is incorporated into the project itself. But we think that that's crucial, not only for the kind of the fairness, like the community is impacted by the project, so they need to have a voice about the project, but it's also like in the best interest of the project itself. If there's community resistance, the project will never be successful. So it's very important to us that this is baked in from the beginning and not for one reason alone. Like it really does benefit everyone when the community is involved.
Excellent. So clearly from this conversation, this is a very, very complex body of work, and I'm not sure if you'll be able to pick just one, but from the top of your head, what would you say is the toughest challenge in getting consensus and alignment across different stakeholders?
The toughest challenge in getting alignment and consensus, I think it's probably making sure that everybody feels heard. And we see this as well, not in just the work that we do. I've seen this in the SBTI working groups, for example. There's a whole spectrum of different opinions. And so I think when heads kind of really butt is when someone feels like they're not being listened to. So I think that making sure everybody feels heard, making sure everybody's ideas are taken seriously, and then if there needs to be a compromise, communicating how you have got to that compromise. And so it's not like one person will feel that they haven't been listened to, or a group of people will feel like they haven't been listened to. I think taking it step by step on how you would get to a compromise, and then also having guardrails for where we can't compromise. I mean, there's a lot of things for communities and health of a community where we're not willing to compromise. So I'd say making sure people feel listened to, being clear and transparent on any route to a compromise if that's necessary, and then also being really clear about where those safeguards and guardrails need to be put into place.
Fiona, another thing I wanted to ask you about has to do with trust, obviously, because trust is a big question in carbon markets. As we know, just as the dust begins to settle from one scandal, there's already another one that's making headlines. You probably heard of the latest one with the Zimbabwe project. Second time around now that there's problems surrounding that one. How do we make sure that trust is maintained as new methods are introduced?
I think the answer always has to be transparency. Like, we can't all be perfect all of the time. And I like to think that a lot of the problems that we see with projects are from a lack of understanding from the developer or errors that aren't malicious in intent. So I think that that's where we need to just hold our hands up and be like, look, this is what happened. We made a mistake here, to be proactive about making mistakes. When I say we, I mean the kind of collective we, whoever is involved in that. And I think that's where the trust can be built back. I think when we feel that a scandal or an error or an issue with a project has been covered over, that's where it really erodes the trust in the markets, in the standard setters. If there's been kind of a project where we feel someone's been dishonest with us, it really erodes that trust. And so I think that transparency is improving in the markets, which is really reassuring to see. I think transparency and understanding as well. So we will make mistakes, all of us, project developers, auditors, the public in interpreting things, standard setters in making rules. We're all going on this journey together. So being transparent, having conversations, consulting with experts when we need to, it will all help to build the market into a stronger place and help to avoid such kind of problems like this, where we can learn from the mistakes that have happened before.
I'm also curious to know, since new carbon removal approaches are emerging rather quickly and older ones are constantly being fine-tuned and becoming more refined, maturing even, how do you balance the need to enable innovation with the responsibility to maintain scientific rigor and credibility, of course?
Yes, I think it's always really important, particularly for the new methodologies, the new project types, to make sure that you're starting from a strong scientific foundation. But it is also really important to innovate and to develop new approaches that might seem quite risky until they've been better established. So again, I think to strike this balance, transparency is really key. So if there's a new approach or we're changing an approach and there's an area in which we're a bit uncertain about, like we think this is going to be a better way, we think this is going to be a more conservative way, but we're not 100% sure, I think we need to be transparent about that uncertainty. Like, why aren't we sure? What would we need to do to become more sure? And that's where I think pilots as well can be a really good way to feed into this. So we learn a lot by doing. And then if we are able to run a pilot, we can see potentially problems that we didn't know could exist. So a way to see the unknown unknowns is a way I like to phrase it. And pilots can be done on a small scale. So if we do get something wrong, we have limited the impacts of that mistake or that uncertainty. And then also making sure that pilots are open for stakeholder and expert feedback. So we all have lessons learned from projects on the ground, from the research that we're doing, and being able to share this, I really think helps to drive innovation in the right direction rather than keeping kind of knowledge pools siloed. And then that's when the transparency as well can be impacted. And so I think as well, for pilots and for innovation attempts, it's really important to not kind of retroactively kind of blast innovation attempts. I think as long as those attempts were run using the best available science and the best practices at the time, we need to remember to frame pilots and projects and innovation attempts in the context in which they took place. Because I think otherwise we're going to risk scaring people off innovating if they think that they're just going to get slammed in the future if their idea isn't perfect in a future context. So I think transparency, again, I guess the answer is always transparency, but also I think pilots and stakeholder engagement and context are really important here.
And in that line of thought, how does gold standard decide when a new approach is ready to be standardized?
One of the things we do a lot actually is running pilots. So running the pilots and then speaking with experts, we're a big fan of a working group. So for example, at the moment, we're running a pilot for digital MRV. And we have a board of experts which have experience across different scopes of MRV and project implementation and digitization. And so we always look to the expert groups before we approve anything. So we will be running pilots, I think, for the next 2 years. And then the results of those will be continuously discussed with our working groups and our governance board of experts, which we call the Technical Advisory Committee. And so there's not a kind of yes or a no, but it's more, it needs to be a discussion. So all of these kind of new innovations, the new project types, the new MRV methods, they all require some degree of nuance to them. And so having those conversations with the experts to really kind of sound out what's been happening and then what the potential could hold in the future, that's then kind of how we decide what we move forward with or maybe what we would need to revise.
Are you ever approached by third parties, say companies that are developing a certain technology or carbon removal solution? Or is this more of a something that you explore internally?
Both. So we kind of watch how the market is growing, and where we see a lot of demand, we try to help to fill any gaps in the demand, particularly from the supplier side. If we see methodology areas that are really highly requested, we see that with the biochar, then we try to fill that gap so that we can get more projects off the ground in the market. But we also have a way in which project developers can come to us and submit their ideas. And then we, again, speak to our board of experts about those ideas and work out what could be the risks, what are the benefits, and then we can move some of those forward as well. So we have both channels, and we think both are really important, being able to support where we can from an internal capacity and also kind of working directly with project developers on the ground who know what they need, and they often will know how to get there.
Do you ever feel pressured as far as like time goes? Because we all have this very acute sense of urgency that, you know, we have to scale the market as fast as possible. But scaling methodologies quickly sounds like it would be at the expense of quality. So how do you guys kind of balance that dichotomy?
Yeah, that's a really hard one, because as well, we are conscious that, I mean, for everyone, time is money, right? Like, we want to get solutions across the line as quickly as we can so that the developers can get the finance, the carbon finance that they need to make their projects happen. But you're right. I mean, it doesn't serve anybody if we're churning out solutions that then have holes in them. Because going back to kind of what we were saying earlier, if we end up crediting a flawed project or issuing too many credits, then that project and the market can really be damaged. So that's the end goal that we need to remember. And it's hard sometimes when there's this time pressure, particularly from the outside, to get the ideas forward. But we just have to be really strong in that we will not put anything out until we are confident that it is high integrity and that it's robust. And that's, again, where our governance process is so key. It's not us making the decisions internally. We need to speak to the experts. We need to know what they think about the different solutions before we put them out there. And managing the governance process and project developers' time is a real struggle. But again, I think that's where the transparency comes in. We have to communicate to the maybe where we're getting the time pressures, why we have taken a bit longer sometimes, like why we need to give something a little bit more thought. It's all for the same end game. So I think if we can make sure that everybody understands the and we're on the same page, then that definitely helps.
Perhaps last major big topic that I really wanted to discuss with you is policy. How or what, in your opinion, is policy's role in scaling carbon removal?
Yes, that's quite a big question. That's quite a big role. I think that...
Perhaps to break it, maybe if we can break it down, how do you see methodologies being integrated in policy and government regulation potentially for CDR?
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting to see all of the new kind of methodologies coming out under policy. So we have, of course, the EU CRCF, and then the UK government is working on new methodologies under what they call their GGR. So I think the policy has a role to play in that it gives market actors more certainty and I guess the confidence. Like if your government is backing a solution, it depends on your government, but you would tend to have a little bit more confidence in that. I think there's a risk in when policy reinvents the wheel rather than building on what exists already, as long as what exists is high integrity. I think we should be building more on what exists rather than creating lots of new things, because I think that really makes the policy quite difficult to navigate. This is a very, carbon markets are very, very complicated. They're complicated already. And I think we need to make sure that, I guess we can do it from the voluntary side of things, but as the compliance markets as well, and we start to merge the two of them, we need to make sure that the language and the way we're referring to things, and also the science that underpins everything, we need to make sure that there's some level of harmonization there. I think that's a key role that we will play as policy is starting to evolve. We as the voluntary carbon market, we need to advocate for this is the best practice, or this is how we should refer to something. And then I think it could be a really exciting opportunity, because if we're developing the policy, we're allowing more of a finance flow so we can scale up the projects and allow more projects. So it can be very exciting. I think we just all need to make sure that it's very accessible as well, because otherwise that could be quite limiting.
Is gold standard in any way involved, like in any government consultations for any countries or like the EU, for example, or is this something that's in the works?
Yeah, so we actively engage with a lot of different governments about integrating the voluntary carbon market or gold standards, VERs, into compliance schemes. And we've also worked with the EU a lot to help to guide the development of their carbon farming and carbon removals initiatives. So we get involved wherever we can. It's really important that we've been in this market for a long time, and we really need to help to shape it based on our experiences and the best practices that we've learned from doing this for so many years.
Excellent. Excellent. So looking into the future, how quickly do you see like a convergence of voluntary and compliance markets? How quickly do you see kind of the stepping in of government and regulation scaling the market?
In terms of scaling the market, do you mean like how long until we think will impact?
Yeah. Yes. Comparing to like how we've seen things develop so far, and starting from the point where we're actually starting to see a convergence, like an actual convergence happening.
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing the convergence happening already. So as we said, we've got like the UK, the EU, I know Japan's doing a lot of great work as well with their compliance scheme. And so we're starting to see those markets converge in the early stages. I think this is having kind of a twofold effect. So it's making this a key topic so that other governments can see this is a way in which it could work, or these are multiple ways in which it could work. So maybe we should try that. Maybe we should follow the UK, or maybe we should follow the EU's approach. So I guess kind of going back to that idea of pilots, these initial governments are leading and they're piloting these different ways in which to use compliance schemes, and then how to interact or how to merge, which bits to merge with the existing voluntary market. So we're seeing different approaches, and that's already great because we're starting to see and trial what could work, what looks the best, what will work the best. I think having that government backing, even before these schemes are truly integrated and up and running, having that government backing gives project developers confidence now that there's a future for us. Like, the governments are backing us. Like, there's a potential carbon revenue here, not just from the voluntary side and for good acting corporate, but from the compliance side as well. So it's starting to get those wheels turning from the supplier side, so developers can be confident that they can invest their money into getting the projects off the ground. And so I think we're starting to see a lot of that now. A lot of the schemes that already exist are looking towards the end of this decade before things are kind of really going to be off the ground. But I think things are moving very quickly. So I'm interested and excited to see which other governments and national bodies will step forwards and also get involved and develop their compliance schemes.
It's definitely a very curious matter, yes. This kind of got me thinking, actually, what about insurance? Does Gold Standard work with insurance bodies? Carbon insurance bodies.
There's something, yeah, we've been talking with insurance bodies a lot for the last couple of years, and different suppliers as well of insurance. And that's something that we're currently discussing with our experts, our advisory committee, because it's a really exciting new kind of approach in carbon markets. And I think it really adds a lot of weight to the kind of offerings of, like, we want to offer a lot of different solutions. Like, at the moment, we rely on, for reversals, for example, we rely on contributions to a buffer pool, but that isn't necessarily the best way of working for every project developer. So for insurance has a lot of promise. We haven't, as far as I'm aware, endorsed one particular insurance mechanism yet, but it's something that we're really thinking about, and we're engaging a lot with the different providers to learn about the different products and solutions they offer.
Excellent. So that kind of brings me to my last question for you before I let you go today. What upcoming new developments does Gold Standard have lined up for the next weeks, months maybe?
The next weeks and months are going to be very, very busy. So I think one key area, I should have mentioned this as well when we were discussing the policy, but one key area that we're working on is to align with the Paris Agreement. So there's a lot of documentation coming out under Article 6.4, the Paris Agreement crediting mechanism, and we're working really hard as a standard to review this documentation and then incorporate the elements that we think are going to increase integrity, and then also challenging the elements where we think they're not going to increase integrity, or where we think it could be problematic or challenging for project developers to implement on the ground. So digesting all of this information, it takes a very long time. But we're hoping to do this to reduce the burden on project developers. We're also working to expand our methodologies to cover different project types and different sectors. Like I said, on the engineered removal side, biochar is the one that we've been requested so heavily. And we see some gaps in the current market offerings where not all of the methodologies will allow artisan production, which is really important for the kind of SDG impact and local communities. But then we also have the promise of these large-scale industrial facilities. So we're working on something that will hopefully enable the whole spectrum of solutions, and so that's a very exciting thing that we'll hopefully have coming towards the end of the year, and not just limited to removals, of course. So we get a lot of new concepts, and we're working on a lot of new concepts in the emission reduction space. Agriculture is a key one we've been working on this year. blue carbon and then industrial emissions paired with a just transition is another really key element that we're working to develop. I'd say last but definitely not least, a real important part of all of this from the standards point of view is that we have expanded our team that support project developers through the certification process. So like I said, carbon markets are very, very complicated. And so we want to help developers to navigate this space. I mean, there's no good having all these methodologies if they're too complicated for people to use. So we really want to think about how we can enable project developers to use these methodologies and get their projects certified and make the real impact. So there's a lot going on. We'll definitely be busy over the next few months and seeing all of the new stuff that's coming out after COP as well and all of the Article 6.4 work.
Wow. As if your work weren't hard enough already. Excellent. Fiona, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely to speak with you, and I have a whole new appreciation for the extremely complex and also highly important work that you guys do. Thank you again.
Thank you for taking the time and for asking all of these questions. It's great to have people interested in this space, in the market. So thank you.
Absolutely. Much, much appreciated.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Carbonstations podcast and would like to hear more conversations like this, please be sure to subscribe. We really appreciate the support.